From the company.
Okay, we can begin.
Yeah.
So, welcome everyone, good afternoon, and thank you for coming today. My name is Mada Shemut, I'm an assistant professor in human rights and politics here at LSC Sociology and co-director of LSC Human Rights. This book launch is co-organized between LSC Human Rights and the Middle East Center here at LSC. I want to start off by thanking our two sociology comms people, Maddie and Laura, who did all the organizing as usual and hold up everything that we do. It's my immense pleasure to welcome you to the book launch of Dr. Kusha Safat's Revolution of Things, the Islamism and Post-Islamism Models in Tehran. Dr. Safat joins us from the University of Tehran, where he's an assistant professor in sociology. Dr. Safat, or Kusha, as I usually call him, since we were both PhD students in sociology at Cambridge. During that time, I had the honor of witnessing Kusha bring the discursive and materialist term in the humanities and social sciences into conversation, perhaps into war. As our other co-PhD at Cambridge Sociology also witnessed, to completely reconfigure the social and political history of post-revolutionary Iran, and even to reassemble how we think about the relationship between materiality and language overall. So this book, which we'll hear more about today, traces how this relationship between things and terms shift and how over time, over space perhaps, in different ways, and how this reforms the very ground through which we act in the world. So the book offers us, in other words, a compelling set of methodological and conceptual tools through which to rethink not just post-revolutionary Iran, but other places as well. And I myself, in my own work on Pakistan, have thought with Kusha's work. So thank you very much for the book. Dr. Safat will be joined by Dr. James Karen, lecturer in Islamic South Asia at the Department of History at SOAS. Dr. Karen, or James, as I call him, is a transdisciplinary scholar of the Islamic world from the early modern period into the present day. His research work includes and involves and engages poetry, history, and religion. Like me, he has also stretched some of the conceptual and methodological propositions that Dr. Safat offers us to think about some of the sites that he is working through, but the speaking world in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And of course, I also think James work a lot. So I won't speak anymore. I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Safat.
Well, thank you. I want to begin by thanking Magish, as I call her. for those of you who've been following her work, you'll know that she's not only an incredible scholar, but also an incredible organizer and an incredible activist. So I'm really excited to be able to bounce some ideas off her today. I'm also really grateful to James, as I call him, for accepting to be a discussant today. The fun fact here is that when James was a PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania, I was a master's student there. So I've been looking up to him and learning from him for quite a long time, and really pleased to be able to share this session with you. I'm grateful to the Human Rights Center at LSE and the Middle East Center at LSE for hosting me, and I'm especially grateful to the Ginkgo Foundation for supporting my work and for making this book tour possible. Not least, thank you all for coming, and I look forward to having a conversation during the Q&A.
If I may. Okay. Now, before I get to Iran, I'd like to give a brief overview of what this materialism is about. Beginning in the 1980s, but especially in the 1990s, a group of scholars who were inspired by science and technology studies initiated a radical deconstruction of sorts, or a reassembling of the social, as Bruno Latour would say, by turning their blade against the vocabulary that the cultural turn holds dear, right? So imagine concepts like power like domination, episteme, discourse, and coloniality were no longer to be presupposed or deployed as resources with which to explain other social processes. Instead, these phenomena were themselves to be interrogated by exploring the things that helped engender and sustain them. Right? The point was to show that everyday things are not subordinate to power, but constitutive of it. Now, a third generation of cultural sociologists have really developed this vantage point and have shown that the physicality of an environment is interwoven with what is politically thinkable there. And I'm going to give you a very brief example from my own work, which involves a critique of the literature on Islamism in Iran. Okay? The narrative is this, that shortly after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini imposes Islamism as a top-down strategy, and what is distinct about this Islamism is its draconian prohibitions, right? That this kind of narrative is linked to a mode of writing history which is centered on powerful men and powerful ideologies and so on. And it never actually answers the question, well, why was it that this particular kind of Islamism emerged? Islam could be many different things, right? Why not more draconian? Why not less draconian? Why was it that kind of draconian prohibitions that emerged in Iran at that time? Now, a new materialist would begin by answering this question. The place that they would begin would be to establish a relationship, a two-way relationship between any discourse, including Islamism, and corresponding objects, right? So looking at it from this perspective, the way that I address this problem is to show how dead bodies from the Iran-Iraq conflict and their proliferation across Iran mobilize terms such as martyr, sacrifice, and good and evil into a discourse of martyrdom. Now, the silent reference of the discourse of martyrdom, its sovereign reference, its material reference, right, are corpses, lifeless bodies. So this discourse, on the whole, had a bias against the body and bodily pleasures. Right, it basically had a bias toward prohibiting anything that would be discursively linked to bodily pleasures. Okay, now the point again here is to always try to show the parallelism between material things on the one hand and concepts and ideas on the other. And this is one way through which you can push back against Oriental accounts of the Global South. Right? But of course, this body of work is not without its flaws. And one of those is that the uncritical incorporation of science and technology studies and its bias toward present forms of materiality has led many scholars to ignore the relationships between absent material things and our present conceptions of the world. Right? But more importantly, in my view, we've discarded the relationship between absent material things and the modes of thought that such an absence is foreclosed. And this brings me to Iran. And what I'm going to do today is to establish a relationship between the exclusion of women's bodies, the development of domination as a political field, and a certain air of transcendence that Ayatollah Khomeini begins to attain in the 1980s, okay? Now, when I say the exclusion of women's bodies, what I'm referring to is the hijab. And for those of you who've been following politics in Iran, you'll know that the hijab was made compulsory shortly after the revolution. And you may have a visual conception, right, of what this hijab is. I'm going to show a bit of that, but then I'm going to try to also show a different image, another way of looking at the hijab and what it really is.
Not what it really is, but what it could be. Okay, so
when the hijab becomes compulsory, becomes the law, two forms of hijab are standardized. Now, this is not, the quality here is not great, but you see there's some women in the back, and what they're wearing is the chador, which is a long fabric that covers the entire body, except the face, and the hand can slip out. Right?
This is one way in which the hijab was standardized, and often the color is black or very dark colors. This is a different form of hijab which was standardized. It's called mantel matmeh, which is a long coat that you wear over long trousers, and you have this headpiece that you have to slip your head through, right? And the color here is pretty standard, navy blue, you also have black, you have gray, and the colors and the shades in between, okay? Now, I like this picture. It's from a Facebook page that's called The Hijabless Women, or the Unveiled Women of the 1980s, or the Rebellious Women of the 1980s. And you might wonder why, but I'm guessing this woman in the green, right, she seems pretty rebellious, she's wearing this green, and it's very bright, and it strikes out as somebody who is not towing the line, but this happens to be an exception. The two pictures that you saw before this, right, those seem to be the norm in the 1980s. Okay, so this is what you all are more or less familiar with. But there's a different way of thinking about the hijab, and what I've done is a bit silly, it's a bit corny, but I think it gets the point across. I go back to the couple of years leading up to the revolution, right? So this is in 1978, it's in Tehran, and you see a woman here on the right-hand side who's wearing the chador, her legs are there, and obviously you have these two other women. This is what actually happens. All right. This is a picture taken at the University of Tehran. You see that she's wearing red boots. This is what happens. Now, of course, the externalization of things from the public, including women's hair and their skin, is centered on women's bodies, right? But everything that discursively pertains to bodily pleasures is also pushed out. So if you look at this picture, it's a group of people, you know, they seem to be pretty relaxed, and the guy has a short sleeve. This guy's in the middle, he's rocking long hair, right? That's gone too. The sleeves are, you know, the skin is covered here. The long hair is gone. Right? But it's not just people. So this is a discotheque in Tehran, the last year before the revolution. Oh, it's a very bad quality. These are women dancing, but back here there's a guitar, there's a keyboard, and there's alcohol here on the table. All that is gone as well. Okay? Now, here we have two commercials. The one on the left is for Smirnoff Vodka, and it says "Esalat qabil taghyir nis," which means authenticity is not replicable. So they really admired Smirnoff. This is the Smirnoff is going to go. We know that. On the right-hand side, there's a woman. Her figure is going to fade away. But what else do you think is going to disappear here?
The bust of Mona Lisa?
Well, that's a strange one. Let's come back to that. The Mona Lisa actually stays for some strange reason. But here, the woman, her figure is going to fade away. But what else?
Bottles in the frame.
Yeah.
So, the diversity of these consumer goods becomes highly restricted. Now, remember that the referent of this discourse of martyrdom is a lifeless body. So it has as many prohibitions on the body as possible, and these items become quite restricted. You have two brands of ice cream, two brands of chewing gum, one brand of rice, you know, you have one brand of sugar, and all domestically produced.
So all these things are pushed out. This is a cassette tape, and it has pop music stored in it. You can see traces of it.
And the reason is, well, you can't, you can find cassette tapes in Iran in the 1980s, but if you're caught with it, for instance, in a roadblock, and they search your car, you could get in a lot of trouble for having this cassette tape. Okay? Now, what is happening essentially is that a lot of things that pertain to bodily pleasures are pushed out of the public. But what's interesting is that at the same time that this is happening, certain words are also vanishing from public circulation, right? Words like plurality, like rights, like freedom.
So if you look at this here,
the term plurality, in 1979, it's used quite often, right? Then it just goes down, and it hits ground zero in 1983. Now, how would you explain this correspondence between the elimination of certain objects from the public and certain words vanishing away from public circulation? The way I try to explain it is the following. The term plurality here no longer had objects to address, right? The prior or the conscription of everyday things into this battle of good versus evil and pushing evil objects such as women's hair, their skin, cassette tapes, and so on, out of the public and into the private domain meant that the middle ground had no objects to speak of, so that it was not an objective place to begin with, right? The term plurality had no ground on which to emerge and no things to which to circulate, right? So you see it sort of fading away.
The same with the term rights.
So for those who can remember that time, I wasn't there, but if you were there, Carter was very big on the human rights discourse, right? And Iran at the time was quite close to America. It was a proxy of the U.S. And so that discourse was also very central in Iran. So you have the term rights being used all the time, okay? But then it goes down in a very steep way, and it hits bottom in 1982. Now again, what you have is this solidification of this battle of good versus evil. You have the state, which is executing people, sometimes up to dozens on a daily basis, right? And the pictures of those who are executed are published in the newspaper. At the same time, you have the anti-revolutionaries who are assassinating people that they think are connected to the regime, right? And you have this matrix that, along with the prior conscription of objects into this battle of good and evil, makes the term rights a very convoluted one. Like, you don't know what it actually refers to. If I were to give an example, and I've only recently watched the Game of Thrones, but it provides a really good example. You know, the King of the Dead, what's his name? Have you all seen it? No, okay. Anyway, it's an army of dead coming, right? And there is no negotiating here. And everyone sees themselves as good and the other side as evil. So within this context where you don't negotiate, it's kill or die, right? This term doesn't really have a meaning, right? So it kind of fades away.
This one is an interesting one,
the term freedom. And in Free and Freedom, Azadi. I interviewed six journalists who wrote for different newspapers at the beginning of the revolution, and I asked them two questions. The first was, how did you get this job? Right? And they were usually family members of key revolutionaries, or they were very close to the circle of, you know, central revolutionaries, so that's how they got the job. The second question was, well, when you got the job, was there ever any censorship at the level of words? Did anyone ever tell you not to use the term freedom or free? Right? And the answer is that words did not matter so long as they could contribute to a content, right, that supplemented the revolution. And one of the interviewees reminded me that the slogan of the revolution, Estiqlal Azadi Jumhuriyye Islami, translates to independence, freedom, the Islamic Republic. So freedom is part of the slogan of the revolution, but you see it sort of fading away. Okay? So what do you have now? Just as certain material things are being pushed out of the public, you have a liberal discourse with terms like freedom, plurality, and so on, which is muffled, okay? And this has consequences for politics. For instance, there is no debate at that time about whether it is okay to send children to war. State censorship is one aspect of this, but it's not the whole story, right? In the absence of a liberal vocabulary, the notion of children's rights is not a public concept. Okay? Now, this doesn't mean that there were no ethical misgivings about sending children to battle, that there wasn't grief. Sometimes even war recruiters would object and say, I cannot enlist this kid because it's too young. And those who insisted that the kids had to be enlisted would often frame their demand in terms of spirituality. They're spiritually ready, right? But the important thing is this, that grief and ethical misgivings were not framed in the language of rights in general and children's rights in particular. In order to be intelligible, it had to be framed by the dominant referential discourse of the time, which was martyrdom, okay? Now, I'm going to give you an example from a life history account that I think sort of drives the point home. The person who I interviewed, his name is Reza, and he explains this scene to me. He walks out of his home. It's in 1983-84, because the calendars don't align, but it's either of those. He walks out of his home, and he sees a group of people on the other side of the street. He walks toward the crowd. And there is a picture of a young martyr, around 14 or 15, on the wall, painted on the wall. And someone has drawn a body for this face with a white chalk, two hands, one holding an ice cream cone and the other a toy truck,
a toy car,
right? Now Reza is a bit perplexed. He feels uneasy about this. He looks around, a couple of people are smiling, right? But there's a sense of uncertainty. Reza feels that somebody has probably disrespected the boy, you know? And when an old man comes and wipes the drawing away with wet cloth, there's a sense of relief. Yeah? So, if we were to speculate that some raw Banksy before his time was trying to tell people that, look, we're sending children to die, right? And that's what the ice cream cone is meant to represent. Regardless of whether that artist meant that, or whether certain individuals within the crowd understood it as such, in the absence of that liberal discourse, this interpretation escaped the crowd as a whole. The boy was a martyr, and you either loved him because you were a revolutionary, or you hated him because you were an anti-revolutionary. So in the absence of a liberal discourse, it's not clear what a Banksy type subversion will be, what resignification would constitute, or this endless notion of agency that we often have in the human and social sciences. Would that be successful in such a context? Right? Now, what is remarkable to me is how this arrangement of public things even shaped the nature of private dissent. Okay? When you look at the biographies of people who were against the state in the 1980s, inside of Iran, from 1981 to 1988, you don't see an understanding of a systematic way, a conception of a systematic way to push back against the state. Ayatollah Khomeini seems to be beyond the reach, beyond the law, and he seems to be interchangeable with the Islamic Republic. So this leads to two fantasies for these dissenters. One of them is the regime's implosion, right, because of its own backwardness and so on. The other one is a foreign invasion. The key thing is that the subject sees no role for itself in either scenario. And this constitutes, to use Derrida's term, Khomeini's transcendence. Right? What does this mean? What do I mean by transcendence? So God is a good example of this. And it has a paradoxical nature, right? On the one hand, it's very much a part of this world. It's constructed through language, through materiality, through rituals. So it's very much embedded here. On the other hand, it's the originator. So it's at the origin. So it's very much beyond this world. It's outside of this structure, right? Of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that God is beyond this world. It means that it appears to be beyond this world. An appearance is linked to objects visible to us. So Khomeini's transcendence was linked to the exclusion of some objects from the public and the regularization of other objects within the public. Right? Okay. Now, I'm going to bring this to an end with a few sentences. For me, the key point to remember is that material absences are always actively and not so innocently produced as non-thinkable alternatives to what exists. In other words, every type of domination is constituted by some form of material absence. And this should push us to at least consider positioning ourselves at the wave crest of material disappearances, to consider how such instances of loss foreclose certain emancipatory modes of thinking. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Husha, as I call him. James?
Great. Oh, thanks so much for your talk, Kushal. That's what I'm going to call you. but, right. So, I mean, as you know, I've been engaging with this work for quite a while, like several years now, I suppose. And I was really excited when the full book came out. And much as I've assigned a version of that talk to students for a number of years. I'm probably going to do the same with other parts of your book as well. I had a couple of, before we sort of put it to the group as a whole, I wondered if you might sort of flesh out the structure of the book overall.
Yeah, so the first chapter is basically this thing that most books have to be, which is sort of a rundown of what you have to expect and, you know, a theoretical discussion and so on. But the story really begins with chapter two. And here, it's a very different kind of an argument than what I presented today. It's about how a revolutionary subject is born at the intersection of Shariati's revolutionary discourse and everyday objects, right? So here, the dominant way of looking at things is to say that Shariati came up with this radical text, this radical discourse, and people who read it, they became radicalized and they became revolutionary. Well, the question for me is always, why did Shariati become important? Why that text, right? And I find nothing radical within that text itself. I don't think that you can find anything radical within either a text or a material configuration. It is the merger of this text with asymmetrical objects and class disparities that generates a radical world, right? So if you look at Judith Butler, for instance, as late as 222, she says that every form of materiality is determined by some discourse, right? or gets its final determination through some discourse. Now, you could reverse that and say, well, you have all these signifiers, and the way that they are, the signification happens is that it finds a referent that acts as the referent, right? Well, neither case is, in my view, very accurate. You have affordances in Shariati's text, and you have certain affordances in that world that people were living at the time. And it was the merger of these two that created that revolutionary environment, and it gave birth to a lot of subjects who then called themselves revolutionary. So that's the argument in chapter one, and it's a life history account. So you follow this one guy's trials and tribulations as he, you know, sort of encounters these different objects and sees Khomeini's image on the moon and all that, you know. Chapter two is this, but that life history account still proceeds. So what I'm trying to explain here is how domination came to be, but you know, I also in the book try to show what the lived experience of domination is through that life history account. And the next chapter is the decade after the one that I just explained, so it's in the 1990s. And what happens there is quite interesting. So so all these terms, right, that you see sort of fade away, very shortly after the after 1991, they pick right back up, all of them, right? Everyone starts using them. And so the argument there, again, is that now the entry of these European consumer goods, right, the inflow of mass consumer objects, they start acting as reference for these terms. One now has the right to choose in plural markets, right? Of course, this doesn't mean that everybody who's using the term freedom is referring to being able to buy this shoe or that shoe or whatever, you know? But without these reference, would that term have circulated as it did? And this is the next chapter, and then there's the other chapter, the final chapter, which sort of works out how two very distinct material linguistic worlds develop, and the climax of that is the Green Movement uprising in 2009, and these life history accounts sort of just are sprinkled throughout the book. Thank you for that question.
Right. So you've got the first one, which is the life history account. You've got this talk. You move on to beyond domination to like rupture in the 1990s and war in at the end of the 2000s. I wonder if you might talk a little bit more about your conceptualization of rupture and
sure.
conceptualization of war. And this is a bit of a selfish question, largely because your work was really useful to me and my colleague here, Mohammed Salman Khan, who Salman, as I call him. when we were ourselves working on materiality and language with regard to war. Mm-hmm. So, we didn't have your book available yet. How do you conceptualize rupture? How do you conceptualize war?
So, one of the struggles that you all probably face when you enter the human and social sciences is that you have a lot of terms that are often used and nobody really knows what the exact meaning of these terms are, right? So the domination is a key term. You know, you just throw it around, this is a dominating structure, that's domination or rupture and so on. And in fact, my struggle with domination was that, well, if the liberal context is conceived as domination, if the 1990s in Iran is considered domination just because it was the Islamic Republic, then what is the difference between that world and the world that I just described, right? What is the qualitative difference between these different sorts of domination, okay? So the way I try to theorize it is to say that, look, a public act like resignification, right, like the way that the Green Movement protesters went to their rooftops and they started chanting Allahu Akbar, and Allahu Akbar belongs to the state, to the establishment, they take that sign and they re-signify against the person that sort of claims that sign, right? So this is what you call re-signification, okay? And in order for this public act to be successful, you necessarily need two horizons of intelligibility, right? It's as if you need two discourses to be present for this to find to register as meaningful. Okay? So for me, domination happens when one discourse is muffled. And for that reason, the relationship between a word and its referent becomes quite stable, right? And it becomes very difficult to re-signify anything. Yeah? So that for me is that's how I try to articulate domination. Now, what's interesting is that when all these new objects enter Iran, all these terms begin to refer to ever-changing material reference. Nothing is stable anymore. Freedom refers to this today, tomorrow refers to that. A woman driving in her car, her scarf falling off, and she's speeding, she feels that's freedom. Fighting for women's rights in the Senate or the Majlis, whatever it's called, that's freedom, right? It's not clear what the referent of this term is, right? And so this is what I call rupture. It's when the relationship becomes unstable. And war is when these two linguistic and material worlds develop to a point where they begin to vie for centrality. Okay, and the mark for that, to me, is the possibility of resignification. So what Butler sort of advances as, you know, a theory of resignification presupposes a political field which has different referential systems. And this is not always the case. The world isn't like that everywhere, right? And that's what I consider to be war. So all sides face the possibility of defeat because there is resignification, and now you have numerous types of agencies that you can mobilize.
Just one last thing before
Sure.
I just open it up to the people in the hall.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I really liked particularly about your first chapter is you're sort of describing the material conditions in which this sort of young person was able to kind of link himself into Shariati's, what do you want to call it, like political cosmology.
Yes.
And this was a result of like living the split life between his pious grandfather's extremely spare Spartan like house and his father's sort of shaggy haired like a den of iniquity that he lived in.
In the hood.
Yeah. and he kind of like crafted for himself this sort of cosmology which could link these two things in a single system. He sort of found his own way to negotiate materiality and transcendence. But in all of this, so the affects involved in this were transferable onto the affects of the revolutionary discourse. Now, so where's and at the same time, like this is a kind of not discursive thinking, right? Like Shariati made sense because it mapped onto a sort of
material world.
But a material world that the juxtaposition of things in it had its own sort of thought process, akin to the interplay of images in poetry rather than concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where does a couple of different things fit into this intermediation between discourse and materiality? Number one, possibly material semiosis. Number two, the affect involved in not just from the material side, but from the textual side as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very key question. And I would agree with James that the key intermediary between language and materiality is affect. And I don't hone in on it in the book, and that's true. And that's that's something that I have been thinking about more recently. But I suppose that the way that I would
address that is to sort of try to show how Reza, as his subject position develops, you know, becomes immersed in these worlds through certain affective, you know, junctures. But that's a good question. I think that the affect people would have a couple of critiques, a couple of key critiques to have in advance on this book.
Okay.
I was making this up as I went.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, Salman isn't as good an affect person as you'll find.
Okay, there you go.
Have you a critique or something?
Salman, you're welcome to share if you have a thought.
Yeah, no, I was thinking, sorry, yeah, still haven't read the book. This is the second book launch in the last 1 week that I'm attending. But my introduction to the book is from that article that you wrote a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in the notion of affordances,
yeah,
which materiality and absence of it allows.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, with this martyrdom and the bodies of martyrs, or the corpses, if you want to call it, do the affordances that they allow vary across time? Because, I mean, and I'm speaking to it from a different kind of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I've worked on the mannequins in the marketplaces, which are even more mundane kind of thing that you see and don't notice. But we saw that, yeah, one side of the war inscribed meaning onto it by beheading it. If you see the videos circulated by Taliban of just chopping the heads of the mannequins. But then later on, when it evolves with the memory and time, it kind of provide different types of affordances. So did this happen to the bodies as well, or was it just...
We didn't have in Iran this number of corpses after the 1980s. But I think what you're pointing at is something critical, which is that affordances, they're, it's like a potentiality. It's not definitive, right? So if you look at the transcripts of Europeans that arrive in the Americas, some of them are explaining this, you know, jungle that is just insane. The diversity is insane. It's incomprehensible, right? At the same time, when the natives are explaining that area, they're referring to it as a garden, right? Which is very organized. It has a rationality. Right. Now, are these purely discursive differences? I would disagree. I would say that there is a mode of thought that is European, and when it merges with that kind of materiality, it sort of renders it incomprehensible. At the same time, there is an indigenous mode of thought that is linked to that materiality in a different way. So if we were to analytically divide this material and this ideational world, right? Divide them, separate them, and this in itself is kind of problematic. But if you were to do this, the point is, for me, that neither has a final determination on its own. It's always through the merger of these two worlds. And this is why I think that when you say that this is what Islam is, it doesn't make any sense. The Islam that merged with corpses in Iran, that's one Islam. The Islam that merged with war in Afghanistan, that's a very different Islam. The Islam of Ibn Sina, in which, you know, he drank wine, that seems to be a completely different Islam, right? So it's this materiality, its affordances, and how it plugs into certain discourses that gives you that phenomenon, that social reality.
Yeah, that, I think that's what's important. The affect and how it, the materiality kind of encounters the discursive, and then it reshapes the discourse to some extent as well.
Yeah.
Right. Why don't we open it to the group?
If anybody has
a question.
Go ahead. Please, if you could present yourself and.
My name is Sam. I'm doing my second PhD on Kurdish studies. Iranian Revolution with the Kurdistan. Thanks for your presentations. My point is not just about your work. Both scholars work on Iran and Iranian Revolution with an Iranian study. When talk about society, Iranian society as a single unified society, or Iranian Revolution is in 1979 as a single unified revolution, I think you kindly ignore the Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. What happened in Kurdistan in 1979 was not an Islamic revolution. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the other revolutionaries in the rest of Iran. Yeah. I acknowledge what happened in Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, Mashhad was an Islamic revolution. Mm-hmm. But geographically speaking, what happened in Kurdistan in 1979 mm-hmm. was a democratic, secular revolution. Mm-hmm. And regarding the mandatory hijab, it was not mandatory in Kurdistan till 1983 or 84. Mm-hmm. Or if you collect data regarding the words such as plurality, freedom, rights, it will lead to completely different figures that we should. Yeah. I think we had two different revolutions in Iran, 1979, an Islamic one and a democratic one.
Yeah. Absolutely right. And I totally agree with that, but I think it's more than two. There were many. There was even a secular revolution. Now, the point here is that the reason that a lot of people from my generation who focus on Tehran, right, is because of our own trauma with the revolution, right? And we're trying to figure out what this thing was that happened, right? Now, if you look at not just Kurdistan, but even in the south in Balochistan, you'll see that daily life is configured by the rhythm of sandstorms, or, you know, many other things that have nothing to do with sanctions that are, you know, or the things that are of concern to Tehran, right? So when you do speak of Iran, it's never the whole country, and that's a very clear point. And even when I keep emphasizing Tehran, because the book is about Tehran, and I keep saying that this is about Tehran, even that is sort of a unifying concept, because even in Tehran itself, you know, not everyone had the same experience, right? So I think that's a very accurate statement that you made, and I acknowledge it several times in the book, and I think that if we can have someday a sort of Iranian studies that doesn't presuppose Tehran as the center of the country, you know, then that would be a much better field. Thank you.
Just one single point. In a proposal regarding Kurdish autonomy, published in Etelal paper, just 1 month after the revolution on March 1979, in Article 20, it's mentioned clearly that religion must be completely separated from the state.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks. I have lots of questions. I will insert in the chair soon. But before I do, do you have a comment?
No.
Oh, perfect. go ahead.
So my name is Jana Bartic. I'm a social and political theorist at Durham University, and I did do my PhD in sociology together with Mavish and Kusha. So I wanted to say, I have.
I'm already worried about your question.
I have witnessed.
I'm going to answer this. All right.
I think or some of the genesis of this thesis, I'm really glad that it evolved in this direction. It was really a pleasure to listen to it. And I was going to say, I'm afraid I'm going to have to read your book now. So my question is not going to come from a regional expertise, because I have none, but rather from a theoretical point. But I think not dissimilarly to what you seem to do in your book, I'm going to use the personal observation or an ethnographic observation to draw out a theoretical point. And I'm actually interested, Mavish, in what you think about this as well, because I vaguely recall you have some familiarity with Denmark as well. So anyway, in 2013, I moved to Denmark, having previously lived mostly in Central and Eastern Europe, and then obviously having spent quite a bit of time in Western Europe. One of the first things that I observed in Denmark was something very similar to what you are describing, which is the scarcity of objects compared to any sort of standard capitalist context. So, and another colleague of mine, I was doing my postdoc there, who emigrated from Romania but was born after 1989, observed the same thing, said, I'm feeling really sort of anxious about the fact that when I walk into a supermarket, there are only three brands of laundry detergent to choose from. And I remember feeling very split about that observation because A, it did strike me as odd as well, because at that point, having sort of gone through the sort of post-socialist transition, et cetera, I had in fact gotten used to a diversity of capitalist objects, market-based, right, including what you get can get in terms of everyday objects in supermarkets. On the other hand, I understood, obviously, that the relative scarcity of objects in the Danish context was an outcome of a particular approach to social democracy, affordability, etc. And I was really conflicted about what it meant, right? So I couldn't really figure out whether, and I was also very curious about how people who would have grown up in Denmark would have perceived it, right? So whether they would perceive that as a relative scarcity of objects, whether they would perceive that as a sort of limitation or reduction of something that some people would say is kind of, in effect, an illusion of choice. The theoretical reflection of this point is to ask whether, and I'm assuming you might have done this in the book, excuse my ignorance and I will read it, whether you engage with the distinction between objects that are absent but remembered, so sort of present felt absences, and objects that were not even conceivable or not even conceived of. So whether that kind of absence makes, or the difference makes any sort of sense, or whether it's important in your theoretical frame.
Yes.
I will, for my ethnographic observation of growing up in Denmark, the question of whether it was felt as an absence and whether it's an interesting one.
I think we have a collaborative.
Yeah, we have a conversation afterwards. Let me have a think about it.
So I think that I need to clarify this theoretically. When we are talking about absence, as Jana pointed out, we're always talking about two different kinds of absences, right? So all of the absences that I focus on are the sorts of absences that leave a trace of themselves, right?
Yeah.
So imagine language itself. Imagine this. There was a pause here, and now that I'm talking about that pause, everything makes sense. But that pause already had a trace of what came before it in it, right? So this kind of absence is the kind of absence that you can always chase. Now, there's this other radical kind of absence, right, which Hegel kind of pushes to the side. He doesn't want to deal with it because it messes up his dialectic, right? And this kind of absence would be something like the connection between non-human species not being included in social and political history, the result of which is a linear way of thinking based on technological advancement, right? So you don't even understand that the radical absence of this form of linearity is the prior exclusion of non-human species of plants and animals from social and political history. Right? Now, that's a very generative kind of absence, and the reason that I can talk about it is because a lot of people have gone to different parts of the world and they've done the anthropology of indigenous peoples and they've brought in different kinds of perspectives, and now they're like, okay, I see a trace of this. But so these two absences are quite critical. Now, even when women's hair and skin is pushed out of the public, right, at home, that's not the case, right? So it's still there, it's still in memory. But for me, the key point is this, that imagine looking at a woman's hair within the context of a home, right? It plugs into all these different things in a certain way. Now imagine it in a very busy street where thousands of people come and go. It plugs in with various other stuff. And then all of this is public. Right, so it's like as if there's a sort of synthesis between that background of shared meaning and that hair. Right, so for me, the private is quite important as always. Right, but it's how it manifests in the public domain that sort of, that becomes the link for me to politics. Not to say the personal is not political, but the personal, when it becomes public, it becomes political. Does that make sense? Okay. All right.
So while other people think about their questions, now I can slip mine in. You talk about bodily desire and it being cut out, taken out in a way like in the images where you take them out. But I'm also just thinking around, I guess, I don't know if you include bodily desire within the scheme of materiality, but bodily desire also in a way pre-exists much of this. So how does that emerge in some of your conceptualization? And I'm especially remembering a conversation, a cafe conversation a couple of years ago, where I think that you were referring to a famous conversation between Foucault and Chomsky, about Chomsky arguing
there's something
already
in essence.
Yes. And you being like, Chomsky got unfairly dismissed. Or somehow, I just
changed my mind now.
But. Okay. So where does this bodily desire then?
All right. So this was an interesting point that has also been raised by James before, and I think that there are two key points that I take from the materialism, the new materialism. One of them is that all things are relational, right? So this table, its agency is enacted or activated through a relational positionality that it has with all these other stuff in this room, okay? But there's another point as well, which is that, for instance, an axe has competencies that are different from a table, and it cannot be easily replaced by any other signifier. So its competencies are important regardless of how they're enacted in a relational context. Okay, so these are the two things that you want to take out. And what I've focused on today in this chapter was the relational aspect of materiality. And in the chapter that James highlights in the chapter one, that focuses more on the materiality of the moon and how that sort of becomes involved in politics. In terms of bodily desires, you're absolutely correct in the sense that what I'm trying to say is that things that discursively pertain to bodily pleasures, so you don't even really have this predetermined category of bodily pleasures. When I say discursively, I obviously mean it very much within the cultural context of that place, right? And I think that it's here the boundaries between what part of this is materiality and what part of this is language becomes quite difficult to distinguish. So as my favorite, or your favorite philosopher would say, how much of this is materiality and how much of it is discourse? Where do you draw the line, right? And so I think you're absolutely correct in pointing that out. Sometimes it becomes quite difficult to tell how much of that bodily pleasure is actually bodily and how much of it is constituted culturally.
I wanted to just check if there's any... I actually do have more. I'm going to go ahead and throw this one at you as well. So maybe a little bit linked to that indirectly in my maybe stereotypes around Tehran and underground culture. Is I'm thinking when you were speaking, there's of course what publicly is taken away or cast out, but I'm assuming also the emergence of an underground circulation of objects and potentially also underground circulation of discourse. So where is that here?
Yeah, so what's interesting, and I will tell this from my own recollection as a kid, VCR tapes, when I was a kid, it was an object that was sanctioned, right? And you would probably remember this. And not everyone had it. If you had it, you would watch a movie on it for a couple of nights, and then you would wrap it, you know, in a blanket and hide it somewhere and take it to a friend's house or a family member's house and give it to them. But the most awesome scene was when the guy who would have to, who would rent us the films, the cassette tapes, or what do you call it, the VCR? Yeah, the way that he would enter with a bag, and it just, it felt like a drug deal. You know, he would come, and he would open his little suitcase and say, these films, you know, these are Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's Rocky. And I would say, what are those? And he would say, no. You know, these two, you can choose between these two, right? And then he would like shut off his thing and just slide out at night. So there is this underground world, but again, you have these experiences that are kind of detached from each other. You have this kind of free play that exists, but it's as if it doesn't generate a discourse, a language at the level of multitudes, because the private spheres are so detached from each other. You know, that's the way I think about it.
I'm Layli, I'm a fellow in the sociology department. My question is in some way related. It's less about the private public, and I guess there's a lot of sort of dichotomies we can think about or employ, and I'm just thinking about art or poetry or these sorts of Iranian kind of cultural production that is famous both in Iran and outside of, in a way, for sort of breaking through that, right? And the complexity of the use of language to offer us so many potential resignifications, I guess. And I'm just wondering if that's anything you look to in the book or elsewhere.
Yeah, so I don't look at it, but there's something very interesting. Is this not working?
It should.
All right, so
you remember the picture of Mona Lisa? Was it Mona Lisa?
Okay.
Yeah. It's what's funny is that that doesn't disappear.
Yeah.
Or national television shows images of foreign women, right? If they're actresses and they're in some like series, they're there, you know. And so it's a very strange thing how, on the one hand, you can sit in front of your television and watch this woman who doesn't have the hijab, but she's foreign. And then when you walk out, everything, you know, there's hijab everywhere, you know. And it's a peculiar thing, you know. Where does that fit in? Truthfully, I don't deal with that in the book, but I think that that would be an interesting way of problematizing this dichotomy between the private and the public.
I'll now allow for other people to step in before I step in. I don't know. Actually, any other?
I do.
Oh, you do. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. If, no, if someone who hasn't asked a question.
Or comment or thoughts. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to ask you to actually say a bit more about what you mean by intelligibility.
Intelligibility?
Or you don't have to. Or you can choose not to.
No, I will.
But in the sense that you use it a lot in this presentation, and you know, the thing that I kept thinking about is, in part, and this isn't to play devil's advocate, because I think I probably need to read the argument in detail in order to even be able to suppose as one, even only for pedagogic purposes, but I think in some ways intelligibility is also a relational construction, right? And in a lot of ways, what is assumed to be intelligible or not intelligible, or what the political subject is meant to be able to intelligate or to make intelligible to themselves is to me quite interesting, especially in the context in which, and I fully agree with you on the point about the sort of intermediation of relation between the material and the discursive, as much as I would not go into a dualist mode anyway, but I'm really curious.
We could talk about this for hours, but let me just give one example that's actually from the piece Chakrabarti. And what he's trying to explain is how a person in India in the 19th century, right, has a relationship with God that in no way can be reduced to his beliefs, right? God is a player. You defer agency to this God, right? And it's very active everywhere, okay? Now, the moment that you begin to write a secular or a Marxist history of this event, you have no choice but to reduce that God right, to that person's belief. So this, to me, shows a very good example of what I mean by intelligibility. You know, that mode of a relationship between a person and God just is unintelligible within this context.
So, sorry, then intelligibility by definition involves a third, which is basically the writer slash observer. Intelligible to us.
So here's the thing, within the Western context of, in our epistemology, person or species A is different from species B because species C said so by virtue of its rationale. Now, if you look at, let's say, the indigenous in Amazon, I as species A, I'm different from species B. Because species B sees me in a light that's different from the way that I see it, you know? And so this idea that I can sort of distinguish between two different species based on standing outside of those two is just unintelligible to the indigenous. Yeah.
Can I ask something that's slightly related to the intelligibility point, which was something that came up in relation to, I guess, another context that was in, was just to reflect a little bit about what I think comes across as very spatial metaphors, war, battle, I think also placing a subjectivity and intelligibility on a kind of playing field. So you said God as a player. And I was wondering about that sort of, because there's also something about seeing politics as a space or ground of war.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a kind of a militaristic imagination of politics,
mm-hmm.
which of course is also there in your use of your key concepts in the book, which structure the three chapters of domination, rupture, and war.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and there was somebody who brought this up actually in relation to a PhD student of mine, where the student was asked, why do you have such a militaristic conception of politics?
Yeah.
What about other kinds of conceptualizations about how politics could be configured, for example, I mean, in that particular context, the person brought up feminist, bodily embodied ideas, or maybe more thinking around temporal dimensions of politics, I don't know, but I just wondering if you could reflect a little bit.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting question, and I acknowledge the complexity of it. What is interesting to me is that for close to 30 years, Bruno Latour was trying to sketch an image of politics that could not be reduced to a Marxist position or to, indigenous position, that it was something that would be inviting, something that would consider the earth, something that would consider nature. So not this war, this feud over who is included and excluded. So he really, really, really tried. Right, and then there was this criticism, which was pretty accurate in my view, which was that no matter what idea you come up with, what happens when you throw this emancipatory idea into this world that is highly asymmetrical and it's bound to reject it, right? And what is ironic is that his last book before he died, it's called The Rise of an Ecological Class. After feuding with Marxists for such a long time, he still maintained his critique of Marxism, especially the methodological critiques. But it seems that at the end of his career, he acknowledged that there is the issue of how do you bring people together in a movement to facilitate whatever brilliant idea there is about politics, right? And so to me, this is still a key problem, and it's part of the reason that I have a hard time letting go of this sort of idea of politics that is inherently Aristotelian, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let me pick up on your method point, because that's something I found very interesting. And I was almost going to book Krusha to do a session with our PhD students about this, which is about, and it was something we used to discuss in our PhD program that Krusha did, maybe with some slight jabs at Kusha. Which was that the book is very deeply engaging with three interviews. Is that correct?
Three life history accounts.
Two in particular.
Yeah.
And I actually am also very, you know, I actually quote Kusha on one of my papers because I also rely on some life history interviews. But I want you to speak a little bit about that. You also talk about Naghme Sorabi, I think, in your introduction, and about how she challenges linear narratives of the Iranian Revolution through life history, in part.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you could take...
So going back also to his point,
yeah.
Right? So this is very interesting. So when the Islamic Republic sanctions a history, when it advances a history of the revolution, as you would see it on the national television or the books about the revolution that are published inside of Iran, okay? These books are about the victory of the Islamic Republic, right? So the beginning of this history is 1942 and Imam Khomeini's famous speech in which he ridiculed the Shah. Now, most scholars who live outside of Iran, 1962, that's right, sorry. But if you read scholars who live abroad, right, and these were people who were revolutionaries at the beginning of the revolution, more often than not, they were Marxists, they were lefties, right, and now they're in exile. When they write the history of revolution, they're not writing the history of the victory of the Islamic Republic, they're writing the history of the defeat of the left, right? So for them, the starting point isn't 1962. It goes way back. It even goes back to the Constitutional Revolution, right? So it's always critical to remember that where you stand determines how you tell the story, where you stand at this moment. Now, the problem is that these dichotomies have become so clear-cut, right? Now, a person who is pro-Islamic Republic is, by definition, against the left. And a person who is a lefty is by definition against the Islamic Republic, right? Because of the way things are now and the rupture between these two histories. However, if you go back to the beginning of the revolution, you see many people who not only believe in the Ayatollah, they like him, but they also have a picture of Che Guevara on the wall. They're also lefties, right? Because at that moment, in the beginning of the revolution, these distinctions aren't quite clear cut yet, you know? In some places there are more than others, and in some places less. Now, Naghme Sohrabi, who is a very good historian of Iran, and she's based in, she's in the US, her idea is that if you do life history accounts, right? If you go back and get a life history of a person, this distinction becomes muddy. Right, because they tell you their daily lives, and they tell you that they had a picture of Che Guevara and Khomeini, and then you ask them, how'd you reconcile it? And they would say it wasn't an issue, right? So life history is one way to get over these kinds of methodological issues. For me, there's another way to do it. Right? Life history is definitely important. But what happens when you bring objects into the fold? Right? Everyday things have affordances, and you can recover a certain history by tracing the relationship of that affordance with whatever linguistic world that is relevant to it, right? So for me, the way that you really get at an object and what it does and how it does it is, in fact, through life history accounts and how that subjectivity is shaped by this material world. A lot of people, they go directly to the material thing, and they try to write a history of the matter. Mm-hmm. But when you're writing the history of the matter, you're actually writing the history of power, mm-hmm. right? When you want to write the history of matter itself, that's when you go to the subject. That's when you try to see how this subject was formed in relation to this material world. And that's how you're able to trace that agency within them, right? So that was
very, very helpful. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
James?
Yeah. I mean, like as we've been talking, I feel like it's getting, you know, more and more and more abstract. I don't know. Actually, the book isn't that way. You know, that's one of the things I like about it. Really, I mean, it's got these sort of passages of theory which are extremely useful, but it's also got this really sort of concrete sort of description, you know, like of people and the world around them, which, you know, I think I said that before. You know, I think that it really gave me a sort of, I felt, having read it, that I understood more about how a revolutionary subjectivity is formed than anything else that I've read, to the extent that, you know, for students in this class, political Islam, which I have to teach, you know, I think that would be immensely instructive. But at the same time, so to switch from just biographies in the book to biographies generally, like, why did you write this book? And why did you write it this way? And why are these the things that you wanted to focus on? Like, what made you start thinking about objects? And, you know, what's the...
Yeah. There are a lot of reasons, but I really get very frustrated with the sort of Wikipedia-type descriptions of the complexities in Iran and how those complexities are reduced, you know. And so I really wanted to get the nuances and sort of try to show the complexities in one way was biographical account. In terms of objects, I don't know what it was that spoke to me, but perhaps what I remember from all these different places that I've lived at, whether it was Pune and Bombay in India, or Tehran and Bam in Iran, or Atlanta and Long Beach, California, and Philadelphia, and then Cambridge, all these places. I think the smell is what I really identify with. The colors, you know, the tastes, those are the things that stand out to me. And so when I immigrated to the United States, I was 11 years old, and I remember I just couldn't stop looking at the pavement, you know, because it was a different color, the texture was different. And that, for me, was a world beyond what I had known, and so I was always very attuned to this material surroundings that I had.
I'm going to give people in the room a chance.
Can you tell me more about how you use philosophy of Islamism as a
framework? Yeah. So basically, I am the title gives the impression that I'm using them as a framework, but in fact, it's a conversation with this Iran scholar named Asaf Bayat, and it's his term. And it's a critique of the way that he uses these terms, you know. So he's very subject oriented, and I'm trying to say that that's not how post-Islamism works. So for him, the idea is that you know, Islamism is this pre-imagined entity that, you know, is imposed, you know, by Ayatollah and so on, right? And of course, I mentioned some of the problems with that. And post-Islamism to him is this context where that sort of radicalism is gone. People don't abide by, you know, the religious text anymore, and there is this liberalization. And then he traces that to a number of religious intellectuals who reinterpreted the sacred text and borrowed from Western concepts to create this discourse of the reforms, and then proliferated through their magazines and books and circulated through their writing. Right, that's the narrative that Asaf Bayat uses, and this is post-Islamism. And to me, that's very problematic because it doesn't explain how these terms went way beyond these little circles of people reading their magazines, you know. And so that's why I refer to all these material things that acted as reference for this discourse of post-Islamism. Now, another thing that I think Bayat ignores, and
generally the field of Iranian studies ignores, is that when he says post-Islamism, it's as if Islamism has ended, right? But what actually happened at the same time that the reforms emerge, the Hezbollahs get reconfigured, right? And this tendency to reduce them to the tool of the government, right? It sort of prevents us from seeing the dynamics that are there, right? And they're not the mere tool of the government. They're not the mere tool of the state. They have their own worlds. And what is interesting about the Hezbollahis is that their discourse remained the same. So terms like sacrifice, which was used in the 1980s, terms like good and evil, right? It remained the same throughout the 1990s, but their material reference changed. So whereas sacrifice in the 1980s referred to dying on the battlefield, it now came to refer to enduring the asymmetry between objects and these class barriers, right? Whereas good and evil during the 1980s referred to Khomeini and Saddam Hussein, now it sort of referred to the chador, which the poor Hezbollahis, and at that time there were poor Hezbollahis in southern Tehran, could afford, versus the evil type Italian jeans that were also quite expensive and they didn't have access to, right? Now the Hezbollahis are pretty rich. After Ahmadinejad, they got really rich. But at that time, it wasn't the case. So again, the idea of post-Islamism, of leaving something behind, completely ignores this other group of people who are also reconfiguring their own mode of life and reigniting their own Islamism. Yes?
I just want to check if there's anybody else in the room who maybe hasn't gotten a chance. No? Okay. Yeah.
I just want to mention much before Hassan. Yevan Abrahamian had the same mistake regarding the end of Islamism in Iran.
Yeah.
In his very famous Iran Between Two Revolutions, in the first edition in 1918, he predicted that this Islamic revolution leading by Khomeini will be end soon, and the pro-Soviet Tudor party will take power, like something happened in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Abbas Amanat, you're talking about?
Yevan Abrahamian.
Yes, Abrahamian. Yes.
In the first edition, published in 1980, Iran Between Two Revolutions.
Yeah.
But he completely deleted this part.
But Asif Ayad is now, wrongfully probably, or rightfully, known as the guy who coined the term post-Islamism, you know? But I'm sure that it goes before him.
I think that a nice kind of note, or maybe, I don't know if you want to say one, some final...
I was going to do something similar.
So okay. Proceed. No, please. I was going to ask you to talk about... I thought it would be interesting. I remember around the end of the time that you, at least were finishing your dissertation, Trump got elected. And you took the key concepts of rupture, war, and domination and thought about it in the U.S. context. That this is the first, I remember you said to me, now there's war in the West.
Yeah.
And in this moment, where we also have an encampment of LSE, you have mass people. Also just as you were speaking about objects, of course, and the way that plurality and freedom and rights disappear, which is the opposite in the West, where it's the only thing you can really talk about, the only way you can actually conceive of any kind of world of justice, that is now beginning to crack. So I was thinking that would be a good place for
Yeah, it is actually. When I was a teen in America, my feeling was that there was a hegemony of the Bushes and the Clintons. And to me, it was very difficult to understand what an alternative imaginary is in terms of official politics. And I remember this moment in Occupy Wall Street when I was in New York, and they had projected the Facebook page of Occupy Wall Street on a wall in New York. And I was standing there looking at it and looking at everyone, and nothing was happening. Because no one felt threatened, no one felt danger. And I was comparing this to 2 years earlier in Tehran, when people went to the rooftops and they started chanting Allahu Akbar, and the security services were frightened, were completely frightened, you know? And so I was thinking, well, how is it possible that you can, you know, project something subversive on the wall and no one even looks the other way, right? And to me, that represented this domination, this lack of an alternative imaginary in which you could re-signify things. With Bernie Sanders and Trump, I felt that that hegemony, you know, had experienced a rupture. And it seemed that now you had these two worlds really vying for centrality. Whereas in the past, I thought that the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats were minute. You know, they didn't really go deep enough. They didn't really contest each other in a completely meaningful way, you know. And I felt that when Sanders and Trump came, that this represented two worlds. And of course, I wasn't thrilled about it because there's always the possibility that the person that, you know, you're against wins everything, you know. But I felt that here's a complete shift of ground in politics in America. And I feel that we're seeing the reverberations of that now.
Thank you so much.
James, any
final words?
No, that was
really
good.
Okay, well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming. And thank you to Kushan. Congratulations again on this fantastic book.
Thank you very much.